Brendan Gill once wrote, "Happy writers have histories shorter even than happy families. The whole of my professional career can be summed up by saying that I started out at the place where I wanted most to be, the New Yorker magazine." Since selling his first New Yorker story back in 1936, my guest Brendan Gill has written short stories, profiles, talk of the town pieces, and theater reviews. The life of that magazine was the subject of his best-selling book here at the New Yorker. A new edition has just been published with an updated introduction chronicling the end of an era. Last year, the magazine was sold to a new publisher, which ended William Shawn's 36-year editorship. In January, Gill revived the long-dormant Skyline column about architecture, which Lewis Mumford used to write. Gill had already immersed himself in the subject of architecture while preparing his biography of architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Gill knew Wright as a reporter, then as a friend. The biography has just been published. It's called Many Masks, A Life of Frank Lloyd Wright. Welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with Frank Lloyd Wright's epitaph on his tombstone, which reads, "Love of an idea is love of God." What does that mean to you?
It's a nonsensical epitaph for that man, and I'm afraid it was the handiwork of his widow, Olga Vanna, who rather fancied herself as a mystic, and there is no possible way that you can analyze that and make that make any sense. And Frank Lloyd Wright himself had no particular belief in God. He was a kind of, as I'm afraid I described him, as a kind of maudlin pantheist, a maudlin Whitmanesque pantheist, but he wouldn't have thought that that was a good thing to put on his tombstone. And it was like the family motto, truth against the world, which the Wright family always believed that it possessed. But if you analyze truth against the world, that doesn't mean anything either. What truth? Whose truth? And what world? Whose world? So it's a kind of a grandiose statement, which is best not thought about.
It must have been difficult on one level for you to write this book because he was a friend of yours in the latter years of his life. And I think, in a way you want a certain distance when you're writing somebody's autobiography. It helps to know them, but then you don't know what your responsibility is to them as a friend and what your responsibility should be as a biographer.
Well, if the man is great enough, and if also the very question of the nature of his greatness has been discussed with him, as it was in my case, more than once, because he was perfectly aware of the fact of his greatness and indeed encouraged everybody to believe that he was as great as he himself believed himself to be, which is the greatest it could be. That makes it less embarrassing to find out that the many things that he caused to come into the world as inventions about himself were devices, were forms of manipulation of the public, because the work is there, the greatness is there. You wouldn't be bothered dealing with a man who lied and stole and cheated and did all these other things if he was simply an nonentity. But great people are worth examining, and everything about them, as Oliver Cromwell said about his warts, is necessary. Put in the warts. And Frank and I often talked about the fact that that there was an element of charlatanism in him, of being a mountebank. And what did that mean? And of course, he gave what is the characteristic answer of mountebanks, but nevertheless possibly the true one, that he said, "I could never get my work done. I couldn't have got done what I wanted to get done without having been this kind of show-off, this element of the braggadocio and all that." And I think that that's legitimate. I think most of the great men of my time, like Picasso and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, other people like that, have had a great quality of showmanship in them, which we might deplore. We wouldn't expect it of Washington or Jefferson, but we expect it now of our public figures, and perhaps it marks a falling off in the quality of the apprehension of life that we have.
You've recently turned to architecture as a subject to write about, both in the Frank Lloyd Wright biography and in your new column.
Well, but I've always written about architecture more or less indirectly, and I myself always boast, not unlike the fashion of Frank Lloyd Wright, that I was an architect from the cradle, because I always cared about it. That's been my avocation all my life. But I didn't want to become an architect because I didn't like taking the courses that were necessary to be taken at Yale at that time. So I chose to be what is called a generalist by just concentrating on writing. But I've always drawn and always worked in architecture and remodeled houses and done things like that.
What do you love about architecture on an idea level?
Well, I think that it does stand for shelter, and I think there are some people who are very much interested in providing shelter for the sense of coziness, some primordial sense of being inside a cave. And all my life, I've made caves for my family. And all Frank Lloyd Wright's life, he was making caves. He was the consummate cave maker, the great hearth, the snugness, the little windows on that side, then the opening up at the cave mouth of the great windows looking south over the lawns and gardens and all that. And I think that there was that element in him answers something in us which probably goes back 18,000 years. It probably goes back to Lascaux. And I think that that's one of the tests of a good building, is that whether you know why you're happy inside that building or not, something in that building makes you happy. You feel better than you would in a building that makes you uneasy. Much of contemporary architecture, you know, makes you uneasy. And at first we don't understand why, but there are reasons.
I want to quote something that you wrote in your first Skyline column, your first New Yorker column on architecture. You wrote, "It is the wanton and ever-accelerating destruction of New York in the name of improving it that I will be addressing in this column." And then you started to write about all the new buildings that are going up in Manhattan that are mostly being bought up by out-of-town millionaires, foreign millionaires.
And I say in the column I had in last week's New Yorker that I don't even know who any of these people are. You know, they're crudely referred to as Euro sleaze. These people who come in with immense fortunes and are buying up our sunlight and our air in these areas in the sky. And you look up at them at night and they're all dark, 10 or 15 floors without a light, because they're not living there. They're simply warehousing our sunlight and air for future profit, and it's an intolerable situation. It's absentee wealth, and left behind and unable to live in the very island that they ought to be living on are all the young folk who are now living an hour out of New York and living in slums and paying $1,000 a month for one small room in a basement. It cannot go on, and the indictment that has to be made is to be made to the city government. We have a rotten city government in New York, and it is getting worse. The city continues to be given away.
So you said that the heart of the city is increasingly being owned by absentee landlords. Do you think that this is something peculiar to Manhattan, or is this a problem that you see happening in other major cities in America?
Well, the great cities have had all of them to face that, but of course New York is the magnet. New York is the greatest city on earth, and it is believed to be that by people who can afford to come here from Hong Kong and Shanghai. And every other city, longingly, we are the center of so many things. And we are, in any event, a great city. People, we have something incandescent in New York. We have an energy that almost no other city on earth, I think, has, except my second favorite city, which is L.A., a very unfashionable point of view to have. Everybody wants me to think that San Francisco is better than Los Angeles, but I know that Los Angeles is better than San Francisco because the energy there is coming up out of the street, too. You just feel it. And I don't know enough about LA to know whether that too is being given away in the same sense but we violate the law in New York. We have no more zoning in New York. Anybody who can afford it can break the law, in effect, can see to it that he has a separate arrangement with the city.
But probably you wouldn't think of living anywhere else.
No, I want to be there. I want to see what's happening. Even in when it's threatened, as I really believe that it was as threatened as Rome was threatened with decline and fall, one wants to be there.
My guest is Brendan Gill, and his latest book is a biography of Frank Lloyd Wright titled Many Masks. There's also a new edition of his bestseller here at The New Yorker. Now, you've been at The New Yorker for over 50 years, which is really a remarkably long time, especially in this day and age where people change jobs like crazy. Now, you've seen magazines around you go through radical changes. What are some of the changes that you've noticed, not at The New Yorker, but at other magazines?
Well, when I was young and just beginning to be a writer, just out of Yale, and I not only was writing for The New Yorker at once, and therefore went on the staff, but I used to write for the Saturday Evening Post. I was a short story writer, and I was thought to be going to be a successor to their great short story writers. And one got a lot more money writing for the Saturday Evening Post, of course, in those days, than The New Yorker, which paid very little. And I used to write for Collier's and for Liberty and all those other magazines. And they've all vanished. There were no outlets. I was a serious young man, meaning to write as good short stories as I could. And I would have had the opportunity to sell my stories in maybe 20 or 30 magazines. Nowadays, there are only maybe three or four magazines in which it would be possible to publish the kind of stories that people could take seriously and be eager to see. And a couple of them are serious quarterlies, like Grand Street, for example, which is a new magazine, which is very good about publishing excellent short stories. But that is a big change, because in those days all we had was radio, and we didn't have television, and we didn't have the other seductions of life, and everything depends upon where the money is. And there evidently isn't money enough in terms of advertising to support more than a few magazines which want to take subjects seriously. And the oddity of The New Yorker is that now, today, we're the only magazine probably that if it wants to tackle a serious subject, can tackle it at 10,000 words, 20,000 words. People complain, but the fact is that if you have the guts to tackle an important subject, you can't do it in 1,200 words. You can't do it in this quick TV commercial space of time.
Well, certainly what a lot of New Yorker readers are wondering is, will the new publisher and the new editor, Robert Gottlieb, continue that tradition of pieces taking as long as they need to take? Or will it fall into line with other magazines of having more emphasis on graphics and design and shorter articles that can be easily skimmed or quickly read?
I would hope not, because among other things, I am still employed there myself, which I think is a good sign. And my pieces will be running to 6,000 or 8,000 words, because I can't make an indictment of New York City in 1,000 words. That's just like spitting on it or something. But the multi-part, it is said that Bob Gottlieb is opposed to the multi-part pieces of some of the three or four part pieces that we have run in the past. But so far, in the first 6 or 8 months of his rule, nothing that I know of has changed very much in that respect. And his record, which people tend to forget, that the reason that Cy Newhouse, our new owner, chose Gottlieb to succeed Sean is because Gottlieb had a reputation in book publishing, which was just as high as Sean's reputation in magazine publishing. They were both thought to be great editors and peers of one another. And the outcry at The New Yorker was totally unjustified, as far as I'm concerned, because Gottlieb is intellectually as respectable as any human being we have. And look at what Knopf, of which he was the head editor, has published over the years. They tackle tough subjects at great length. They publish unpopular books.
There was a letter that was written to Gottlieb asking him to resign.
Even before he took office.
So I take it you didn't sign that letter?
I didn't sign it because I thought that was an example of mass hysteria on the part of many writers for whom The New Yorker acts as a kind of surrogate family and surrogate home. And that's nice in one level, but it's not nice on the level of fearing change. I remember I told Sean that I had heard once that the Chinese pictograph for change is the same as the pictograph for opportunity. And that's a wonderful thought. But in the New Yorker staff view, change represented panic, danger, rather than opportunity. And now I think it's all settled down, and I think most of the writers are perfectly content. One or two left, but not many. And we are as eager as ever to be seen to be in that magazine. This is our natural place to be.
You had worked with one editor for 36 years. Was it difficult to adjust to somebody else going over your copy?
Of course we miss Sean as an old friend. And also, all our lives long, we have been writing not for our readers, because one doesn't do that, but for each other. And what I always sought if I wrote a piece was the approbation of William Sean and Joseph Mitchell and a couple of friends like that. And then if anybody else in the world also liked what I wrote, I was grateful. But my heart was with them and with seeking their approval. And so I miss and I'm bound to miss Sean as a friend of 50 years in terms of not any longer being able to seek his approbation. But I will then gradually be eager for Bob Gottlieb to praise me. All we live for is praise.
I know a lot of writers say they get paid so little, they'd better get some praise.
Yeah, but that's what really nourishes us. Money gives delight, but praise is nourishing.
My guest is Brendan Gill, who has written for The New Yorker for over 50 years. His best-selling book here at The New Yorker has a new edition that was just brought out. He's also written a new biography of Frank Lloyd Wright called Many Masks. We're going to talk about his writing more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Brendan Gill. William Shawn, who edited The New Yorker for about 36 years, is probably one of the most, if not the most, now legendary living editors. And I'd like to hear a little bit about what it was like to work with him. When you would write something, knowing that he would edit it, would there be a little William Shawn voice in your head going over what you were writing as you were writing it?
I suppose unconsciously there is that sense that one wants to do well, as a child might want to do well, to do something to seek the parents' pride or praise. Knowing, I suppose to some extent, it would be a defect in one's character to think that knowing the character of the editor, one would write in that direction. So I wouldn't say that we consciously did that, but we could not be affected by it. And now we, having to write for a new person, will make that alteration in our nature.
What did you know that he would say? What did you know he would look for?
Among other things, one knew what he wouldn't like. John Updike, who was rejoiced to be naughty with Shawn and would always put a few four-letter words into his short stories, and then they would perhaps one or two of them would reach the first galleys. And then Shawn would plead, and then, of course, John would take them out. It meant nothing to him except to cause Shawn momentary terror, because Updike knew the short stories would come out in book form, and as he wrote them, with the dirty, so-called, from Shawn's point of view, dirty words, they would be intact. And so there was a certain amount of teasing, I think, of that kind. It was true, however, that may have been a defect in the magazine, and Pauline Kael began to make great cultural literary history by introducing one or two four-letter words into her movie columns just before Shawn left. But it was always over his protests, and it was only when he saw that indeed the language, our contemporary language, is not the language of his youth. He himself has never uttered an imprecation more violent than a very softly whispered, "Oh, God." And beyond that, he has never explored the territory of invective. But as we know, his beloved and wonderful son, Wally Shawn, writes in contemporary speech in a way that must cause Shawn alarm.
Well, in your book here at The New Yorker, you say that one person wrote a short story with the expression cow patty in it.
Yeah.
And once Shawn had figured out that meant cow dung, he wrote, at the first mention, he wrote, "Oh, dear," in the margin. And at the second mention, he wrote, "Surely once is enough." And I wonder how you feel about that kind of gentility. On the one hand, it's in a way what makes one of the things that makes The New Yorker so special. On the other hand, it could be very frustrating to be up against that kind of gentility if you want to cut loose with what you're writing.
Yeah, and under Ross in the old days, swear words were always permitted. We were the only magazine which you could say Jesus Christ or something in a short story. And then the nuns would come in and frighten Ross. They'd hang around the corridor waiting to see him, to scold him for the bad language. But he was speaking American First World War Army language, and he never would utter any of these common naughty words of our day, which are sexual in origin, and especially not in the presence of a woman. But Shawn was even more extreme in that respect than Ross had been, and he never used even the ordinary bad, the blasphemies. And now blasphemy is such a commonplace that wouldn't count at all. And when Shawn had the intention publishing the best black writing in America as it was coming out after the Second World War and all those years. And in point of fact, he couldn't, because he'd prevented himself from doing so, because the natural black language in which they write their powerful short stories is a language that he found impermissible, and he just couldn't bring himself to publish it in the magazine. So it was stultifying not to have that privilege. And the writers who wrote in that language and who write in that language today are not being Peck's bad boy. They're not showing off. This is the natural tongue. These are the words now that my beautiful granddaughters use in my presence, to my astonishment and somewhat to my dismay. But there they are.
Is that something you ever spoke with William Shawn about?
Oh, yes. His argument was that the words were much more conspicuous in a magazine than they were in a book, that you sort of accepted a different frame of reference or a different possibility of speech in a book. And he would say, yes, of course, Ulysses is full of bad language, but the New Yorker magazine, they would start off the page. And I think that was a justification. There's something in it, but not. It was not the truth. The truth was that it was offensive to him. And the great editor says, "I like this, or I don't like this." And he has the limits of his good qualities as well as those of his bad. And so the magazine very much reflected the nature of Sean's feeling about how life should be conducted now.
Do you think we'll be seeing a change in the kind of language?
I think it was, as I say, already beginning to take place under Sean, and Gottlieb doesn't have any of these worries. He's of another generation anyway. Sean is 80. He's of a different generation, even to some extent from me. He's a little bit older than I am.
You've written a lot of Talk of the Town pieces, mm-hmm. which are unattributed pieces. They're unsigned pieces toward the beginning of the magazine. And I always wonder, for the people who write that, what it feels like to not get credit for what you've written. And you've done it a lot. Yeah. Did you really want to sign your name to it? Well, I've never understood this tradition of not signing pieces.
Well, it was an attempt to give the appearance of uniformity to a we. And it also made it possible for lots of different people to be writing in abundance, with a seeming abundance, in a way in which it would detract from that sense of abundance if each piece was signed. You say, well, of course, you can put together four different people. But also, having no names was a tradition in the magazine that grew up by accident. We erected this accident into a virtue. But when The New Yorker began, all humorous magazines had only pseudonyms and initials. Nobody ever signed his real name to anything. Much less, and Talk of the Town used to be signed The New Yorkers. And then we dropped that byline. But the clothing department was signed Lipstick. And so it went.
You write in your book here at The New Yorker that happiness is an emotion not often spoken of at the magazine, much less experienced. It's very funny the way you put it, but I have a feeling that beneath that humor is the fact that there's a lot of very depressed people who write.
Well, humorists are notoriously of a very dark spirit. Nobody on earth has ever been darker spirited than Ring Lardner, say, unless it be Mark Twain. Lardner was always gloomy under any circumstances, but Twain on the stage as a performer showing off was radiant. But in real life, in his view of how life was, he took the darkest possible view. And that seemingly is the source of humor. It's a kind of preemptive strike against death and doom.
You know, a lot of people, when they buy The New Yorker, everyone knows this is true, they look through for the cartoons.
Mm-hmm. That's what everybody does, including everybody who works for The New Yorker.
Well, are you frustrated if you see somebody buying The New Yorker and flipping through it, skimming over all the writing and going for the cartoons, going for the pictures?
I'm sort of resigned to it. Sometimes in the old days when I knew where a short story of mine was, say, in the magazine, and I would see people flipping through to see who had written it and then continue flipping. And that did cause a certain rueful feeling in me. But the fact is that all of us look at the cartoons first and rejoice to think that after all these years, there are still jokes about desert islands, which we haven't had for decades, which are funny.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was Frank Modell, it wasn't Frank. This week's issue of the magazine had a very funny joke about Noah's Ark. How can there still be jokes about Noah's Ark? But indeed there are, and they are funny.
You're really an anomaly in a way, being at one publication for over 50 years. Magazines are almost becoming like radio stations in how quickly management change and formats change. Did you ever feel funny about it? Did you ever feel like, oh, everybody else in the world is changing jobs and going on to different things, and here I am writing about whatever you wanted to, and for as long as you wanted to, and writing books on the side too, but still affiliated with the same magazine. Did you ever feel like, oh, everybody else is making a change, I'd better make one too?
Well, the only temptation would ever have been money, of course, which is the major temptation that most people face, and not sex, as a common misapprehension. And I was invited on other occasions to say to go to work for Time and places like that, which were notorious for paying two or three times as much as we at The New Yorker ever paid. But it was that freedom. And then it, although it sounds as if I'd led a very steady, sedentary almost life by being on one publication, the fact was, as you imply, that I've been able to change jobs inside that, so that I wrote, I was a movie reviewer, I was a drama reviewer, I'm an architectural reviewer, I've done almost everything there. So I changed jobs, and I always suspected in old age that they would then ask me to become a messenger and deliver manuscripts and things, and I would accept that, I hope, with the same joy that I accepted all my other assignments. And I wouldn't be less a part of The New Yorker if I did so.
You seem to be one of the few writers who you know who at least says that they actually enjoy writing.
Yeah, it's almost a shameful confession. It's a kind of a defect in a writer's character to admit it. But then I'm also the kind of person who, when he has written a book, loves to go around the country and talk about his book. And a lot of authors, to my indignation, pretend that this is a torture to them to have to expose themselves to the public in the course of peddling their wares. If they don't like going around this country and having the opportunity to go around this country, why on earth are they doing it? So it's a matter, it's a vogue, it's cant, it's nonsense. Writing is the easiest thing in the world, given comparison with the ditch digger or a collector of garbage or any of the other horrible and backbreaking tasks that people perform. If people suffer writing, it is suffering plainly that they cling to and perhaps rejoice in. So then it doesn't become or can't be called suffering anymore.
Well, I enjoy your writing very much, and I want to thank you very much for joining us and talking to us about your work. Thank you for being here.
Delighted.
My guest has been Brendan Gill, and he's been affiliated with The New Yorker magazine for over 50 years. His best-selling book here at The New Yorker has just been brought out in a new updated edition. He also has a new biography of Frank Lloyd Wright, which is titled Many Masks, and that's just been published by Putnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.